Here's another one from Mary Oliver, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet. This one is called Maybe. Sweet Jesus, talking his melancholy madness, stood up in the boat, and the sea lay down, silky and sorry. Sweet Jesus, talking his melancholy madness, stood up in the boat, and the sea lay down, silky and sorry. So, everybody lived that night. But you know how it is when something different crosses the threshold. The uncles mutter together. The women walk away. The young brother begins to sharpen his knife. Nobody knows what the soul is. Like the wind comes over the water, for days you don't think of it. Maybe, maybe, maybe after the storm, after the multitude was fed, one or two of them felt the soul slip forth like a tremor of pure sunlight before exhaustion that wants to swallow everything, grip their bones, and left them, miserable and sleepy as they are now, forgetting, forgetting, forgetting how the wind tore at the sails when he rose and talked to it, tender, luminous, demanding, as he always was, as he always is, a thousand times more terrifying than the killer sea. I love that one. She knows who Jesus is. Sweet Jesus, talking his melancholy madness, stood up in the boat, and the sea lay down, silky and sorry. So everybody lived that night. But you know how it is when something different crosses the threshold. The uncles mutter together, the women walk away, the young brother begins to sharpen his knife. Nobody knows what the soul is. Sometimes, like the wind across the water, we don't think of it for days. Maybe. Maybe. After the storm, after the multitude was fed, one or two of them felt the soul slip forth like a tremor of pure sunlight before exhaustion that wants to swallow everything, gripped their bones, and left them, miserable, sleepy, as they are now, forgetting, forgetting how the wind tore at the sails before he rose and talked to it, tender, luminous, and demanding, as he always was, thousand times more terrifying than the killer sea. That comes from the fourth chapter of the Gospel of Mark. Jesus had just finished eight mini parables. He's ready to head back across the Sea of Galilee. He's in the back of the boat. The disciples are in the front of the boat. They head across the Sea of Galilee. Terrible storm kicks up just like that, which, as I understand it, not at all unusual in the Sea of Galilee. Only this storm, worse than usual. Waves are crashing against the bow of the boat. The wind is whistling through the boat. The disciples think, this is it. We're going to die right here in the middle of the Sea of Galilee. And they look at the back of the boat, and there is Jesus sound asleep. Don't you just hate it when somebody has the capacity to be completely calm when you are convinced the world is ending? Yes, a few years ago now, I was headed out to Fire Island where a friend of mine has a house. We're going to work on his deck, and we're on his boat. And we go around East Island, the Great South Bay, and there's this great big giant fishing boat in front of us from Captree Basin, maybe 50, 60 people on it. Well, we turn out between that boat and the buoy without any problem. But at the last second, it's way too late to do anything about it, we realize that the anchor line from that fishing boat is stretched taut in the wind almost horizontally. I mean, just about 2 feet out of the water right in front of us. We caught that line right underneath the bow of our boat. It lifted us up in the air like a couple of water skiers going over a ramp. We came flopping back down on the water. The boat just about turned over. I thought, this is it. I'm dying here in the middle of the Great South Bay. And I turned to my friend, who just as calm can be, says, huh, I think we might have run over that rope. My life is flashing before my eyes, and he turns back. Yep, sure enough, ran over that rope. Well, that's what's going on here. Disciples are absolutely terrified for their lives. Jesus sound asleep in the back of the boat. They wake him up, not because they think he can do anything, but because they're desperate for any shot at help at this point. And Jesus says to them, oh, you of little faith. Then he speaks to the storm, just three words. He says to the storm, quiet, be still. I can say that to my granddaughters all day long. Nothing ever happens. Jesus says it one single time to the storm, and the storm just stopped. Imagine that. You're out here in the middle of the Sea of Galilee. A storm is raging. You think you're dying. Jesus speaks three words, and the storm just stops. I imagine at this point the disciples were probably feeling a little foolish for having said anything to Jesus in the first place. But very quickly it occurs to them. If at first they were terrified of the storm, now they have a far more compelling reason to be terrified. Now they're terrified of this man, Jesus. Who is this man that with a few simple words he can calm a raging storm? Like Mary Oliver says, tender, luminous, demanding. She always was 1,000 times more terrifying than the killer sea. I know how they felt about Jesus. It's probably how you and I ought to feel about Jesus. It's how I do feel about him. Drawn to him and yet frightened of him all at the same time. You know, it's kind of like kids at Christmas time. You ever watch little kids at Christmas time? You know, they can't wait to go see Santa Claus until it's actually time to go see Santa Claus. Then they see this large, formidable figure all dressed in red with a long white beard. And hey, he knows when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. He knows if you've been bad or good. No wonder they cry their eyes out when they have to sit in the old man's lap, right? They're drawn to him, frightened of him, all at the same time. C.S. Lewis caught that. It was in his Chronicles of Narnia series of books. Aslan, of course, the hero of the books, a lion. Children are very taken by him because Aslan's their savior. At the same time, they're terrified of him because, hey, he's a lion. And if he wanted to, he could tear them limb from limb. And Lewis was fond of saying throughout all 7 books that Aslan was not a tame lion, you know. And so now the disciples were discovering Jesus was anything but a tame Lord. And I think really for the disciples, this is where it begins. Everything before this is kind of preamble. Everything before this is the forward. Everything before this, up to this time, you could call the once before a time. Not really. The story didn't start till now. This is where once upon a time begins. When they came to the realization we all have to come to sooner or later, the realization that life is difficult, life is hard, life is problematic, life ultimately is terrifying. Maybe it comes to you at the death of a loved one, or it's your own brush with death, or you lose a job and can't find another. Somewhere along the line, though, it comes to all of us that we've been left out here in the middle of a great big ocean with a rickety old ship, a lousy rudder, no sails, and we have to make some sense out of this mess called life. Well, the question isn't whether life is terrifying or not. You live long enough, it'll be terrifying for all of us. The question is, what do you do in the face of the terror? Do you allow it to defeat you, or do you face it head on? What do the disciples do? Well, we have to go to another boat story to find an answer to that question. So we go to the 14th chapter of the Gospel of Matthew. Same story is also told in John 6, a little bit different there. We talked about it last night. Jesus has fed 5,000 people, and a party has erupted among the Jews. We've got a new king for Israel, King Jesus. He'll defeat the Romans, bring independence back to Israel, give us the power we want. Jesus has no interest in this, and he goes up into the mountains alone. Tells the 12 to go back down and cross the Sea of Galilee. You could just see them shuffling back to the seaside because they really want him to be king, because they want to be Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense and argue over who has more power. So when they get back to the seaside, you know, you can see deja vu set in. They look at the boat, they look at the water, they look at the boat again. Whoa, we've done this before. We do not want to do this. And sure enough, halfway across the sea, a terrible storm kicks up. Only this time, no Jesus sound asleep in the back of the boat. To make matters worse, a ghost is walking toward them. The ghost speaks. He says, "Take courage, it is I." Interesting word, courage. I always thought to be courageous meant to step forward without any fear whatsoever, but finally it occurred to me that is not courage, that would be stupidity. Now, courage is stepping forward even though you are absolutely filled with fear. Peter, rather courageously, thought he'd heard that ghost before. So he said, "Jesus, if that's you, tell me to walk to you on the water." So Jesus says, "Okay, Peter, walk to me on the water." Appears to me to be Peter's idea, not Jesus necessarily. So Peter gets out of the boat and he walked on the water. Have you ever done that? I've never done that. I don't know anyone else who's ever done that. Well, actually, except for one time when I was a kid, we had this church camp in northern Ohio, Round Lake Christian Assembly. They had this floating dock in the middle of the lake where you went swimming. And one night they decided to do this Bible reenactment of this story. It was cool. They actually took this floating dock and they filled the ballast in the tanks just enough for the dock to sink right down to water level. So it actually looked like Jesus was walking on the water, except Jesus couldn't tell where the edge of the dock was. And so he fell into the water, and then that's when we found out Jesus didn't swim all that well, which was, you know, and so the disciples in the boat had to save him, kind of ruin the impact of the whole thing. That's the only time I've ever seen anybody walk on the water. It was, yep, memorable. And did the rest of the disciples walk on the water? No. They're all sitting in the back of the boat. "You going to get out?" "No, I ain't getting out." Only one of them has the courage to get out of the boat and walk on the water, and his name is Peter. He takes his eyes off Jesus, falls into the water. cries, Lord, save me. That ain't the important point. I mean, you were saying that earlier today. You know, that's not the important point. Of course he fell into the water. He's human. We all fall into the water. We do it over and over again. Big deal. The point is not if you fall into the water or not. The point is, do you have the guts to get out of the boat? Do you have the guts to get out of the boat? It sounds kind of fascinating to me with the kind of questions that are up. It was interesting listening to Ryan today as he talked about it and said he had no idea what you should do and then proceeded to tell us exactly what he thinks you should do. Kind of got a kick out of that. Seems to me like either decision is incredibly gutsy and is going to take a boatload of courage. Either decision as to where you end up. But now, you know, in terms of like keeping what you got going here, I hate to take this. I've been involved in church planting since 1979. That's 33 years. I know a little bit about it. You know, we've done study after study over the years, and do you know why people come to church? 72% of people find their introduction to Christ on a Sunday morning worship. 72% of them. And 70% of that 72%, you know how they got there? You invited them because you thought it was cool. It was a good place to find some courage and figure out the spiritual stuff. So people come to church, well, you know, sometimes, yeah, they come because of postcards, even when it snows. But most of the time, they come because you invite them. But now, here's the fascinating part. We know why they come back. 80% of people come back week two because they identify with the pastor. You know, I'm listening to him today, and I'm thinking, I want to go to that church. If I'm living in Lower Manhattan, and if I were going to live in Manhattan, it would be in Battery Park City. You know, it's the city. It's not the city. I like that. I always liked Tribeca, too. I thought, if I'm going to live there, I'm going to that church because I trust that guy. You know, and I'm thinking that, you know, when I'm sitting in the back there, the woman sitting next to me appeared not to really be impressed at all with him. Of course, that was Brittany. So, you know, but 80% of people come back week two because they identified with the senior pastor, with the preaching guy. Basically, they thought, that guy, he gets the spiritual journey the way I get it, and I think I trust him, 80%. It's also interesting that 50% of them come back because they like the worship. And you say, wait a minute, that's 130%. We always let them answer two things. Because they like the worship. And today, particularly for the last 6-7 years, they like the worship because of how authentic it is. And I would call that authentic. I really like Eric's stuff. It's just fun. And you lead every week, right? And then the third major reason they come back, about 35%, actually this is a bigger reason why they don't come back. It's about 70% of why they don't come back, is because of the quality of the children's program. It's interesting that that actually has a stronger negative impact than it has positive impact. If the kids aren't happy, we ain't going back. You know, that's for sure. If the kids are happy, we might come back depending on how we felt about worship. Yeah, that's pretty much what we've learned about that. And it's pretty clear Nicole's like figuring that part out. That's amazing what you have going. I like want to bring my grandkids next time. Let them be taken care of. What I mean by that is I don't care where you go, you're going to grow. That seems to me pretty obvious at this point. The church is going to grow. You're going to be taken out of your comfort zone. You all are going to have to get out of the boat and walk on the water collectively. Now, my experience is when I find that going on collectively, in whatever community I'm a part of, it also tends to be going on personally. So then, you know, I kind of ask, okay, so what's the boat you need to get out of? Maybe related to work, maybe related to your marriage or your family of origin, or maybe related to what you're doing or not doing in the church that you could be or could not be doing in the church. You know, how do you need to get out of the boat and walk on the water? You know, being here is bringing back a lot of memories to me. When I took over as CEO of the Orchard Group, we'd started, I think, 21 churches at that point. It was 1989. Our churches were averaging 50 at 5 years of age. They were topping out at about 75 people and realized it was time for us to do something different. And so in 92, we started a church here in Princeton, and we put a whole bunch of work into it. And we sent out postcards, and we were looking for a big crowd the very first Sunday, the first Sunday of December 1992, and 403 people showed up, and we were like in heaven. I mean, I thought, this is like incredible. This is wonderful. We finally figured this out. God's blessing us. And then a year later, on our first anniversary, we had 73. And on our second anniversary, we had 55. And so we waited until 1995, and we did it again. This time in Nashua, New Hampshire, we did it basically doing pretty much the opposite of what we had done in Princeton. And we had 500 people the first Sunday, and on the fifth anniversary, the church was averaging about 610, 620. And since that time, every church we have planted, well, not every church, but on average, our Orchard Group churches have been averaging 50 at 5 years of age, and a lot of them are running well over 1,000 now. And people always say, man, you know, it's a good thing you guys planted that church in Nashua, New Hampshire, that finally turned the tide for you. Tenfold increase from 50 at 5 years of age to 500. They say, man, Nashua was huge for you. And I always say, no, actually, Princeton was huge for us. Because it was the church where we failed miserably, that we learned all the lessons that we needed to learn about trusting God and also about how to maybe do it a little more intelligently. You always learn more from your failures than you do from your successes. The church we started here 20 years ago that we planned and plotted right here in this room, actually, that's the one that really let us turn everything around. And then God's got a sense of humor, because about 5 or 6 years ago, that church started taking off. Now they have their own building right off I-95, and they run about 400 people. So it has turned out to be the success I had hoped it would be in the beginning. It taught me a lot about getting out of the boat, walking on the water. God is calling you as a church to find the courage to get out of the boat. You're going to grow no matter where you are, because you have the tools to grow. Well, by one other thing, this is just a footnote. Do you know that new churches, I did my master's thesis on this for my MDiv, new churches tend to take on the personality of the senior pastor's wife. You know, now there are a whole bunch of reasons for this that people think. There's a misogynistic reason and a non-misogynistic reason. The misogynistic reason says, well, that's she's just the first example of the kind of person who's drawn to the senior pastor's personality. I don't buy that for a minute. The main reason is because generally people coming into a new church, they're not just looking at the pastor. They're looking at the pastor's family and trying to figure out if they identify with that family or not. And if they feel like they identify with that family, husband and wife, then they return. And this has been consistently true for quite some time, which is also good news for you guys. You're going to grow. How is God calling you to get out of the boat and walk on the water? An important lesson learned in a boat. But then we come to our last boat story. 27th chapter of the book of Acts. It's a whole chapter. Paul's a prisoner. First time we've left the Gospels. I think even with what I'm going to do in the morning, this will be the only time we're out of the Gospels. Paul's a prisoner. He's going to Rome to appear before Caesar. He's already been transferred from one ship to another ship. He's in a place called Fair Haven, headed for the harbor at Phoenix. Didn't know there was a harbor in Phoenix. And he goes to the captain and the owner of the ship, and he says, don't sail. He's a prisoner. I mean, who does he think he is? Why would they listen to him? Don't sail. So they go ahead and set sail. And sure enough, 3 days out, terrible storm kicks up. Bible tells us it was a nor'easter. We Northeasterners know what a nor'easter is. Hurricane force winds. They couldn't make any headway against the storm. They just battened everything down, tried to ride it out. After 8 days, the storm is still raging. They started throwing cargo overboard. And after 11 days, the Bible tells us all 276 seasoned sailors aboard lost all hope. And what happened? Paul spoke up, and what did he say? You got to love him. He said, I told you so. You know, God blessed the Apostle Paul with many gifts. Evidently, tact was not one of them. Seems really obvious. And he says, well, the truth is now that the entire ship is going to be broken up into thousands of pieces, but not a single hair of anybody's head is going to be harmed. Can you imagine the confidence it takes to stand up in front of 276 seasoned sailors and say, oh, not a single hair in anybody's head is going to be harmed? You can see them thinking, yeah, right, mm-hmm, and I suppose the Knicks are actually going to win the NBA championship this year, too. You know, they're not listening to him. After 14 days, they haven't eaten. Paul says, let's eat. They sit down to eat. And then he says, let's pray, and they say, okay. These hardened, seasoned sailors. They were hoping to ram the ship into ground, but it hit a sandbar instead and started breaking apart. And they figured everybody who could swim would swim for the shore, and those who couldn't would wait for the ship to break apart and then just ride pieces to shore. That one of the sailors said to the captain, "Wait a minute, before we abandon ship, we got a bunch of prisoners on here that we're responsible for, and if they get away, we will be killed, and so we need to kill them before we abandon ship." And Paul had to be absolutely terrified. Terrified of going to Rome as a prisoner in the first place to appear before Caesar. Terrified of the storm. He's not a seasoned sailor. Terrified of dying at the hands of these sailors. But in the face of that terror, he boldly stands up and says, "Don't sail." Boldly stands up and says, "I told you so." Boldly stands up and says, "Let's eat, let's pray." And when they decide not to kill him, and he gets safely to the island of Malta, what does he do? He boldly preaches Christ in a very hostile territory. Now, if the first stage in life is to find out life's difficult, hard, problematic, even terrifying, and Peter showed us what the second stage of life is, learning to take a little tiny courageous step forward out of the boat in the face of that fear, Paul shows us what happens when you live a whole life that way. When you've taken so many of those little tiny courageous steps forward that you finally have the capacity to take bold leaps forward for the cause of Christ. The question for me has always been, how do I get where he was, where Paul was, with that kind of bold faith? How do you get there? Well, you get there by taking one single step out of the boat at a time. And you move slowly from point A to point C, from being terrified of death, terrified of life, terrified of a God you can't understand, being able to take bold steps forward for Christ. But that doesn't mean some tragedy isn't going to come along and send you back to point A all over again. It's life. But still, you get up that day and you say, "Today, Father, I will take a step of faith forward for you." Hard? Yeah, it's hard. It's the only decent way to live. So my son played basketball, and when he was in like fifth grade, he was on a team. And one day after the game, the coach comes to me and he said, "Your kid's good." He said, "He's really good. I mean, he's not as tall as you, probably not going to be as tall as you, but the kid's good. When he gets to junior high, he'll make the team." Now, they always have like 100 kids try out since the basketball program's pretty big here. They only take 12, but he'll make the team. So, you know, you should nurture the game. And so, you know, I tell Jonathan at dinner that night what the coach said, and instead of being excited, he gets real quiet. Real quiet. I said, "Buddy, what's wrong?" He said, "Dad, what if I don't make the junior high team?" I said, "Well, what if you don't?" He said, "Well, if I don't make the junior high team, I won't make the high school team. If I don't make the high school team, how will I ever get a scholarship to a Division I school? If I don't get a scholarship to a Division I school, how will I ever play for the NBA? And Dad, all I ever wanted to do was play for the NBA." You know, I felt so sorry for him. He's probably, I don't know, 11 at the time, maybe. You know, first time in his life when it occurs to him that maybe, just maybe not all of his dreams are going to come true. And I wondered how he would process the information. So I come home from work a couple of weeks later. He meets me at the door with a basketball in hand. And he says, "All right, Dad, I'm going to a week of basketball camp this summer, right?" And I said, "Yeah, we're sending you to a week." And he said, "Yeah, how many weeks do they have?" I said, "I think it's 4 or 5. And he said, "Yeah, I want to go to all 4 or 5 because I know I'm not going to be as tall as you. And if I'm going to get better, I'm going to have to get better like 1 week of basketball camp at a time." I was so proud of him because he came to understand the only decent way to face your fears is to face your fears. So he did play junior high ball, and he did play high school ball, and no, he did not get a scholarship to a Division I school, but I do think he still could make the New Jersey Nets if he wanted to try out for them. There'd be a real good chance of that one. And he's been taking risks like that ever since. He's just got that kind of boldness, that belief in himself, that strange combination of great confidence coupled with great humility that you see in people who are people of faith. Got way more than I had at that age. Life's hard. Fine. Of course it's hard. The only way to grow in the face of it is to get out of the boat and take a risk. So my buddy I went to clean his deck with, we're working on his boat in Champlain Creek there on the Great South Bay where he has it docked. And it had been a horrible year for him. First, his father had died of a disease that Centers for Disease Control had never figured out what it was. And my buddy's a family doctor, a physician, so it really bothered him that he wasn't able to help his father at all. Then while he's on vacation overseas, his mother has a heart attack and dies and is not able to get a hold of him. And then shortly after that, his six-year-old daughter's diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. You know, it's not a real good year So I'm talking to him that day as we're working on his boat on Champlain Creek, and I said, how did you get through? And he said, man, there are so many times I felt like giving up. He said, but then we were in a small group together. He said, you don't remember when we were studying Markings, Dag Hammarskjöld's book? You know, Dag Hammarskjöld was Secretary General of the United Nations, 1953 to 1961, the height of the Cold War. The Americans had no use for him because they thought he was in cahoots with the communists. The communists had no use for him because they thought he was in cahoots with the Americans. He wasn't making anybody happy. But as a decade wore on, they realized this guy was one brilliant, brilliant diplomat. Then he was killed in a plane crash on his way to what is now Zimbabwe, and the whole Cold War stopped for a week as everybody worldwide praised him for his greatness. John F. Kennedy said he was the greatest diplomat of the 20th century, and maybe the century before. Well, shortly before he died, he wrote in his book, in his journal, Markings, an interesting line, maybe even kind of foretelling his death. He was a Christian, a man of great, deep faith. He said, night is drawing nigh. And then this line, a haunting line, for all that has been, thanks. For all that will be, yes. Wow. Night is drawing nigh. For all that has been, thanks. For all that will be, yes. Now that's somebody who knows how to get out of the boat. So as we're sitting there working on the boat, Stan, my friend, says to me, yeah, given everything that's happened, I just keep waking up every morning and quoting that line. I said, dude, man, it takes a lot of courage to quote that line. And he said, yeah, but it's the only way I make it through the day. Night is drawing nigh for all that has been, thanks. For all that has been, thanks. For all that shall be, yes. Still remember those words ringing off the water as I watched the sun glisten across the waters of the Great South Bay. You know, I thought it really is true. There's a lot of important lessons learned on the water in a boat. So pray with me, if you will. Father, you are always calling us, and discerning your voice is never easy. We'd like to talk with you about that when we get to heaven. You know, we really want you to scream out and shout out to us, go left. You just don't ever do that. Instead, it's this still small voice, like it's been for centuries, maybe coming through a friend, maybe coming through a circumstance, usually not greeted by, oh, wonder of wonders, thank you. Usually we greet your still small voice with a curse word, because you usually are calling us to get out of our comfort zone, to take a step that we're frightened to take. We don't want to trust you to be there. Father, help us collectively as a church, as couples, as families, as individuals, help us to clearly know that we are getting out of the boat, keeping our eyes on you, and taking the risks you want us to take. For this we pray in Christ's name and for his purpose.